right in the middle of the headquarters of the Pakistani military, and the place swarming with U.S. military advisors. And that information was corroborated by my hero, Dan Rather, reporting from Rawalpindi. On the 10th of September, Osama bin Laden was admitted to the military hospital right there in, you know, in Pakistan's military headquarters in Rawalpindi. Anybody who's been there knows exactly what I'm talking about. The military, U.S. military mission is just close by. No way he could have got in there and got in there unnoticed. And then Don Rumsfeld says, we can't find him. It's like looking for a needle in a stack of hay. Well, I can tell you, either somebody is lying there, and I tend to trust Dan Rather, whose report was never refuted, but Dan Rather doesn't connect the dots. And Dan Rather doesn't say, well, if he was on the 10th of September in Rawalpindi, he couldn't have gone back to the caves in Afghanistan the following day. Okay, impossible. And he was under the auspices and hospitality of America's main ally in the war on terrorism, namely Pakistan. Now, let me get into some broader issues. First of all, please understand that revealing the lies on forewarnings does not necessarily help us to establish the truth in this very complex process. Because the unfolding official story, which I think eventually will go into history books, is that the Bush administration is responsible for negligence. They failed to act. There were intelligence lapses. But what is upheld in that process of revealing the lies in the 9/11 Commission ultimately supports the big lie that there is an outside enemy of America. Okay? And read these statements very carefully. The U.S. administration needs a war pretext incident, a justification for waging war. They need an outside enemy. The illusion of an outside enemy is fundamental. It's behind the whole narrative of the United States of successive administrations. If you look at the national security doctrine, this whole idea of preemptive defense of war is there. It's the war on terrorism. The war on terrorism requires an enemy. Now, the fact of the matter is that enemy is fabricated. And I will corroborate this very carefully in a number of documents to show that it is fabricated. Al-Qaeda is fabricated. Al-Qaeda is an instrument. I'm not suggesting that Al-Qaeda is necessarily totally aware. It has certain degrees of independence, but it is being used as the enemy of America. There's no evidence that Al-Qaeda was behind the 9/11 attacks, but the fact is that the whole idea is that the homeland is under attack. We must wage war to defend the homeland. And ultimately, that is the most important thing which has to prevail. And so Richard Clark is saying, yes, we're sorry about all this. We made mistakes. There were intelligence failures. All that is part of the cover-up. Okay? So people who say, Condoleezza Rice, you are lying. Big deal. What does that mean, she's lying? She's lying on forewarnings. Nobody has begged the important question, were these forewarnings emanating from the intelligence apparatus and from George Tenet, are they not themselves part of the process of disinformation, precisely to create the illusion and the impression that there is an outside enemy? Okay? Because without this outside enemy, no Al-Qaeda, no war on terrorism. No Al-Qaeda, no rogue states which sponsor Al-Qaeda. No Al-Qaeda, no pretext for waging a war. No justification for going into Iraq. and Afghanistan and occupying these countries under the disguise of a war on terrorism. No justification for sending U.S. troops into numerous countries around the world, special forces, to help them in the war on terrorism. No justification, and this is very crucial, for developing tactical nuclear weapons to be used in conventional war theaters against Islamic terrorists. The Nuclear Posture Review, which was approved, which was debated in the Senate in early 2002, proposes the development of a new generation of nuclear weapons. I can't go into details, it's a subject in itself, but I can just tell you that back in November of last year, the Senate has given it the green light to use tactical nuclear weapons with an explosive capacity between one-third and six times Hiroshima in conventional war theaters. In other words, they can be triggered in any of the war theaters which are now characterizing this war map in the Middle East, and they do not require the approval of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Okay, they can just go ahead. Three or four-star general can do it because they have been recategorized, and the assumption is that they're harmless to civilians, and they are to be used against Osama bin Laden in the Tora Bora Mountains. That is what you find in the National Security Doctrine. Nuclear weapons, we must develop these defensive nuclear weapons, harmless to civilians, and go after Osama in his cave. It is absolutely absurd, and people believe it, okay? But that is the, so that Al-Qaeda is the pinnacle of the National Security Doctrine. Without Al-Qaeda, they are lost, and they have to make sure that Al-Qaeda remains the enemy. And that is why all this Bush bashing for me is a red herring. Bush didn't know, he made mistakes, blah. All the mistakes in the world upholds the big lie, which is that Al-Qaeda is not an outside enemy, but a creature of the United States intelligence apparatus. And that is something which is not even open for discussion. It is a fact, okay? The war propaganda is based on this whole idea. The project of the new American century, as well as the whole, which is the blueprint for global war and conquest, I can't go into details, but it essentially says defend the homeland, fight and decisively win in multiple theater wars. Again, Osama bin Laden and the rogue states are there, and so on and so forth. It calls for, it makes reference to the catalyzing effect of to a catastrophic and catalyzing event, which will then galvanize the citizenry in support of a war agenda. Bear in mind that these massive casualty-producing events, to which General Tommy Franks, who is the former general involved in Central Command and in the campaign against Iraq, he says very clearly, and he replicates the story that we see in the newspapers this morning, a terrorist massive casualty-producing event will occur somewhere in the Western world, maybe in the United States, which will galvanize the citizenry into supporting the militarization of our society and ultimately accept military rule as a means for protecting democracy. It's such an absurd statement, but it emanates from the... This is not his statement. It is part of military doctrine because he's not speaking in his own capacity. He's speaking as a general, and it's part of military planning. This whole thing is part of military planning. So there we are. Incidentally, the text of my presentation is on the web. You can find it at globalresearch.ca, and I want to now tackle the more important question of the links between Al-Qaeda and successive U.S. administrations, which are corroborated by a number of sources. Let me first give a few a historical background very briefly. Al-Qaeda was created in 1979. It was a project of the Carter administration. It was National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski that actually set loose the Islamic brigades in Afghanistan as a means to triggering the invasion of the Soviet Union. This is corroborated by statements by Brzezinski that he made recently to the French magazine Le Nouvel Observateur. The Islamic Brigade, Al-Qaeda, was supported by successive administrations. Reagan administration supported it through massive financing of the Al-Qaeda network. The training camps, the madrasas were set up, and in effect, what you had was a massive operation which created these Islamic brigades and the whole network. Now, ultimately, what they are saying is, if you read the intelligence reports, they'll say, yes, we did that. Yeah, but that was during the Cold War. That's a bygone era, okay? And in the post-Cold War era, Osama went against us, okay? We had the 1973 World Trade Center bombing. He went against us. He started attacking America. That was called the blowback. But ladies and gentlemen, if he went against us, how come that in 1993-94, which was in the post-Cold War era, based on a 97 report, again, I love these reports because they are coming from the conspiracy theorists of last resort, the Republican Party of the United States, okay? I love them because I love quoting them. And this report is an official congressional document. What does it say? What does it say? It accuses Clinton of collaborating with Osama, okay? But it's even far more precise. It says it accuses Clinton of collaborating with Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, the 1993 mastermind of the World Trade Center bombing. You understand what I'm trying to get at? If indeed this is an outside enemy, how come the Clinton administration, based on Republican sources, was collaborating, working hand in glove with Al-Qaeda during the civil war in Yugoslavia? Was Clinton, when he appeared in front of the 9/11 commission, did they ask him, hey Bill, what were you doing with Sheikh Abdel Rahman there back in 93, bringing in the military inspectors and the Mujahideen and so on? They never used this against him. They preferred to use Monica Lewinsky. At the time of this report, the Monica Lewinsky was initiated at its height. The foreign policy lies, which are shared by the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, the Bush senior, the Reagan, the Carter administration, all administrations have supported Al-Qaeda systematically. And when they tell us that Al-Qaeda is threatening America, they're lying, because they created Al-Qaeda. And therefore, that information, in effect, is, from my point of view, is phony. Okay? Because if the enemy is not an outside enemy, then we're not dealing with an issue of terrorist warnings, we're dealing with an issue of treason. That is what we're dealing with. Now, you might say, well, that was back in 93. You know, Clinton didn't know what he was doing, Madeleine Albright, and so on. Now, let's get a little bit more recent, because then they say, well, that was 93. I'm only giving you the tip of the iceberg, because there's a lot of documents on this. The war in Yugoslavia. We know that in 1999, NATO bombed Yugoslavia. Who was their key ally on the ground? The Kosovo Liberation Army. The Kosovo Liberation Army has been identified as an organization with links to organized crime, the drug trade, but it was supported by the CIA, but the KLA was also being supported by Al-Qaeda. Guess it, yes. So what is that called? Al-Qaeda is supporting the KLA. Madeleine Albright is supporting the KLA. Actually, Madeleine Albright was coveting the leader of the KLA, Hashim Tashi. Now, if you read these statements very carefully, which are again from congressional sources, they raise very serious doubts on this whole idea of an outside enemy. You can't be collaborating with outside enemy and then accuse the outside enemy of, you know, when you collaborate with an outside enemy, that is treason. That's the way the encyclopedia defines treason, when you collaborate with the enemy. Okay, you're in bed with the enemy, but in this case, it's not really an enemy. It's an intelligence instrument or asset, as they call it. And read it carefully. Frank Cialuffo of the Globalized Organized Crime Program, in testimony to the House of Representatives Judicial Committee, what was largely hidden from public view was the fact that the KLA raised part of their funds from the sale of narcotics, etc., etc., of the Golden Crescent of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Again, Ralph Mutschke of Interpol's Criminal Intelligence Division, all in a testimony to the House Judicial Commission. The U.S. State Department lists the KLA as a terrorist organization, but we support them. We support them. And the United Nations supports them, and NATO supports them. And then we acknowledge, but Osama bin Laden also supports them. What do you call that in normal business parlance? You call that partnership, joint venture, when two organizations, the U.S. government, or U.S. military, or NATO on the one hand, support the KLA, and the KLA is supported by Osama bin Laden. And then, in fact, they are right in the, you have U.S. military advisors right together in the same paramilitary organization. That is called complicity, partnership, call it what you want. But Al-Qaeda is not the outside enemy. Bear in mind, this happened in 99, okay? The Cold War had been over for about 10 years. Cold War finished in 89, okay, with the fall of the Berlin Wall. So 10 years later, Osama bin Laden and the U.S. administration, in this case still the Clinton administration, you can see how the Democrats and Republicans are in on this together. They are there in the Balkans using the Mujahideen, using the Islamic brigades to disrupt and destroy Yugoslavia and destabilize it and break it up, okay? And so that is certainly something which is well understood and corroborated. The third excerpt that I have, I think I don't have it with me, but, oh yes, I do. The third excerpt, incidentally, is probably the most important. I don't have it with me, unfortunately. I'll discuss the last link between Al-Qaeda and I don't have the transparency which supports this, but it's on my paper and it's documented in my book that during the war in Macedonia, which brings us to 2000-2001. The KLA had created a proxy military, which is called the NLA, which was fighting the Macedonian security forces on the Kosovo border. Now, it just so happens that the NLA, which is a proxy of the KLA, which we've just discussed, which in effect was supported by the United Nations the United Nations mission in Kosovo. Well, this NLA and NATO And within the NLA, you have senior military advisors from MPRI, Military Professional Resources Incorporated, which is a private mercenary company on contract to the Pentagon. Well, in effect, what happened was that within this paramilitary formation, you had U.S. military advisors, Mujahideen detached by al-Qaeda, and you had the heads of the KLA, which were on UN payrolls, all working together. And this is corroborated by press statements, reports, statements of the Macedonian Prime Minister right up until August 2001. And this, of course, is a very damning evidence, because you can't be on the one hand saying that a few weeks later that Osama bin Laden is the threat to America, when the evidence points unequivocally throughout the 90s in the Balkans and elsewhere that there is a link to that the United States has had very close links to al-Qaeda. And it's confirmed by official statements of the U.S. Congress. The progressive left in the United States supported the war against Afghanistan. Let's put that on record, okay? Now, I'd like to start with this short-term timeline, July-September 2001. Osama bin Laden was in an American hospital in Dubai. That's been fairly well discussed and documented, but again, everybody knew he was there. They could have arrested him, and the hospital, that was documented by a report in Figaro. I won't go into it. The August 6th brief, I looked at it by George Tenet. It's a piece of disinformation, right? The terrorist warnings are disinformation. And now that this, what they're trying to do is to tell you, wow, President Bush was briefed. But who briefed President Bush? CIA George Tenet. Who was behind al-Qaeda? CIA George Tenet. Obviously, these terrorist warnings are fake, okay? I'm not saying that the terror attacks are fake. I'm saying the warnings are fake because they emanate from an intelligence apparatus which is evidently in relation and complicit with the terror network, as documented by the whole history of al-Qaeda from 79 to the present. So you can't on the one hand say, aha, they're going to attack us, but we were collaborating just 2 weeks ago with them in Macedonia. That sheds a lot of credibility on these so-called terrorist warnings. And that's why I say, for people, again, in the 9/11 movement who think the terrorist warnings are somehow an indictment of the Bush administration, I think that's a red herring. They indict the Bush administration, but they support the big lie. And let's be very careful. Supporting the big lie is more important than Condoleezza Rice as a fall girl, okay? All these people can be sacrificed. Whether they lied or not is irrelevant. The big lie is sustained. The terror alerts are genuine. The outside enemy exists. And that's the big lie. So let's get to August 27th. Carol Bruyere mentioned Bob Graham and Porter Goss, my heroes as well, because these are the guys who actually ran the Joint Commission inquiry, okay? They came up with an 800-page report, and I did a search and replace in it. I couldn't find the word of Pakistan mentioned once in the whole report. And then they said it's the Saudis who did it, okay? That's another kind of interpretation which is unfolding. It's unfolding in the context of the $1 trillion lawsuit. It's unfolding in various places. The Saudis did it. Why? Because we want to get hold of Saudi oil. We want to confiscate Saudi assets. And if the Saudis were involved in the conspiracy, or if they supported bin Laden, they always did it because they were proxies of U.S. intelligence. And they had links with their financial cronies in the United States, the Carlyle Group, and so on. They never acted on their own volition. They set up the madrasas, they funded the madrasas, and so on, But they did it in the context of very close relationship with the United States. 27th to 30th of August, Porter Goss and Bob Graham are in Pakistan for consultations with General Mahmoud Ahmad, who is later identified by the FBI as the money man behind the 9/11 attacks. I quote the ABC report of late September. It talks about the money man, the mastermind, and it has to do with this transfer of $100,000 to the ringleader. But again, it's a little bit part of the legend now. It's a way of saying, yes, they did it. They got money. But in effect, the more damning relationship is the fact that if the money man behind 9/11, General Mahmoud Ahmad, indeed transferred money to the terrorists, how come Bob Graham and Porter Goss, the two guys who ran the investigation, were meeting with this guy in Pakistan in late August, okay? And how come the general jumped on the plane barely after the completion of that mission and flew to Washington on an official visit, okay? The money man behind 9/11 is on visit. I mean, again, the FBI is supporting the fact that Pakistan's ISI was involved, that this general was actually providing support to the hijacking operation. What the hijacking operation had to do in the overall process, that is something again which is far more complex. But in any event, we know that he was transferring money. But then, how come the same individual who was transferring money to the terrorists was meeting Colin Powell, Richard Armitage, George Tenet, okay, at least Senator Joseph Biden, chairman of the Council on, of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and as Carol mentioned, how come he was having breakfast hosted by Porter Goss and Bob Graham, in what was described as a follow-up meeting to the meeting they held in Pakistan in late August, okay? And I revealed this thing of the breakfast meeting a couple of years ago, it's very interesting there, because the U.S. media says, when this happened, the U.S. media said, Porter Goss and Bob Graham were having breakfast on the morning of 9/11 with a Pakistani general who is known to be very close to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Okay? They say that. It's in the Washington Post. Now, they don't beg the important question, and they say that after the publication of the FBI report and of the Times of India report and various other reports. They don't say, what on earth was Porter Goss, Bob Graham, Senator Kyle, and others doing with an individual who is identified by the FBI as the money man behind the terrorists and who is close to bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban? They don't ask that question. Okay? Why? Because it obviously raises the issue of complicity at the highest levels of the Bush administration. They don't ask the question, how come Colin Powell was meeting with the general on the 13th of September, corroborated by press reports, to discuss the terms of Pakistan's cooperation in the war on terrorism, which incidentally had been decided right on day one, on September 11 in the evening. They said they actually decided they were going to invade Afghanistan that same day. But again, the decision had been made way back. We know that. But again, what was Colin Powell doing with this money man? What was Richard Armitage doing with this money man? And so on and so forth. Well, the answer is very simple. Colin Powell, Richard Armitage are the architects of Al-Qaeda. And that is very well documented because it goes back to the Iran-Contra scandal when Richard Armitage was in fact behind Oliver North, and Richard Armitage was instrumental in channeling the support to the Mujahideen. We never mentioned Colin Powell. Colin Powell was part of that scandal because he ultimately gave the green light to the transfer of weapons. If you recall the Iran-Contra scandal, it was the United States selling weapons to Iran, and with the proceeds of those weapons, they would finance the Nicaraguan Contra, but also the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, okay? In other words, Al-Qaeda. So that who signed the release forms from logistics and authorized the transfer? It was Colin Powell. And all this was instrumented through transfers. Another notorious individual, Adnan Khashoggi, who is an arms dealer, played an important role in that transfer of weapons to Iran, and the proceeds were used to finance the terrorists. So, essentially, when they invite Mahmoud Ahmad into the State Department and say, Mahmoud, could you help us going after Osama, okay? Because that's what they said. It's a little bit like asking Al Capone in and say, hey, Al, do you want to help us going after organized crime? That is, Pakistan's inter-services intelligence has been a very important link in this whole process of supporting terrorist organizations in the Middle East, in Southeast Asia, and so on. And we have to be very wary that while Pakistan's inter-services intelligence supports the terrorists, Pakistan's inter-services intelligence owes its existence to the CIA. It's a counterpart institution, and therefore there's no way in which this kind of thing is based on failures in intelligence. All this, of course, is there as a smokescreen to distort our understanding of what has ultimately happened. I'll try to complete this discussion in the next 3 minutes so that we have time for the discussion. Just a final word, how to reverse the tide. Carol has intimated several directions. But I think that we have to understand, first of all, that we are at the juncture of the most serious crisis in modern history. We have to understand that 9/11 and the deaths of 9/11 are being used to wage a war without borders, which threatens the future of humanity. It involves the use of nuclear weapons in conventional war theaters, a whole arsenal of new weaponry, the cost of this war also threatening all areas of civilian production and social services. And this war on terrorism is a big lie. It's the biggest lie in U.S. history. The United States wants to establish, whether it's under the disguise of democracy with a new president, or whether it's through emergency rule or military or martial law, what they want is to militarize civilian institutions, because it's very clear a republic is not consistent with an empire. This war agenda requires precisely, the repeal of constitutional government at home. And as long as this outside enemy remains the threat, people will be misled will be galvanized, so to speak, in supporting this war agenda and supporting, saying, yes, we must protect ourselves against this guy. So that ultimately, we have to dismantle the propaganda apparatus behind it, okay? I mean, we have to close down CNN. I'm not saying that. We have to address these fabricated realities of the Bush administration. We have to break the consensus behind this. that Al-Qaeda is a fabrication. Al-Qaeda is a fabrication of successive U.S. governments. Because once that simple fact trickles down to public opinion, the Bush administration's war on terrorism doctrine tumbles like a deck of cards. It has not a leg to stand on. That is the basis of a consistent anti-war agenda. It is not anti-war sentiment saying, hey, Bush, we're against it. Please. It is not dialogue. It is ultimately to dismantle the legitimacy behind this agenda and to point to the criminality both of the war itself as well as of the domestic war on terrorism, including the terror alerts, including the triggering of terror events. And we're not talking about things which are up in the air, since we know that this is an assumption, and Richard Sanders' analysis, you'll hear in the afternoon, corroborates that war pretext incidents do use massive casualty-producing events precisely to gain the support of citizens and to galvanize them into supporting a police state. And that is what we have to do. We have to reach out to our fellow citizens, and in an uncompromising way, the only way to reverse the tide of war is ultimately to unseat the rulers who are war criminals. Yeah, and the way to unseat the rulers is to break their legitimacy in the eyes of the people. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Professor Michelle Chisadovsky of the University of Ottawa, speaking at the Citizens International Inquiry into the Unanswered Questions of 9/11, held last May in Toronto. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Ithaca Radio at 88.1, Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1, KFAR Knoxville 90.9, or Free Radio Olympia 91.3. We continue.
We have three panelists who are going to ask you questions. I'm going to start by introducing Carol Bruyer, who organized Phase 1, as I mentioned earlier today. And one of the things I didn't know about is that she also began the Listening Project, interviewing people on the street in downtown Palo Alto every Wednesday since October 2001, asking questions of people as to how they feel about 9/11. Also on our panel again, we have John Vallow, professor of Chemical Physics Theory Group, U of T, and active in the campaign against missile defense in space weapons and involved in 9/11 events. One of the founding members of Science for Peace and still very much active. And we have Paul Lacroix, who has volunteered on this project with us, who's a private investigator of international criminal conspiracy, otherwise known as a conspiracy theorist. John, would you like to start with the questions of Michelle?
Michelle, like myself, I think feels his role is primarily to get the facts together and see what the situation is and to make that clear, and I respect that. I think he has studied so much of what's going on that he must have insights beyond that. And what I'm hoping to do is to tempt him to speculate just a little bit. In view of the warnings, I haven't met anybody around here who doesn't expect there to be another attack in the next weeks or months. And the question is, what will follow and what ought we to do about it? Because there are various scenarios, and I guess what I'm asking is, what does he think the likely scenario or scenarios is or are? Because there might be an attack which simply served to augment support for the administration and so on, and they would try to return to the shards of democratic structures and so on. On the other hand, they might stick with the military dictatorship, cancel the elections, and so on, at the other extreme. And then you have to think, well, what's their exit strategy from that? Or do they have one? Do they just intend to go on with a military dictatorship? And what, you know, is there any nonviolent resolution of this kind of thing? The point, I guess, of such speculations is that we have to think what we ought to be preparing for, what we ought to be doing now to prepare for the eventualities, both in the States and in Canada. So it's that kind of speculation that I hope to tempt you into, but I don't know whether I'll be able to.
Yeah, I don't like speculating on things which I can't prove. So I think that the question should be addressed, certainly, because there are various scenarios. And perhaps there are three possible scenarios, or maybe four. The first is that there's a terror alert based on an actual terrorist event. And we go to Red Code Alert, and Red Code Alert suspends civilian government, okay? But that's fairly well understood because the Federal Emergency Management Agency has certain procedures, and we know about that. Now, I would say that that scenario has already been prepared because last year they were conducting exercises, a little bit like you conduct military exercises in preparation for war. And Canadian, I mean, I've mentioned it somewhere in a recent article, but I can give you the reference. But it was. These were very serious exercises of municipal government, state government, federal government, with Canadian counterparts. So the Canada is in on this agenda. Now, whether that will actually lead to a permanent suspension of constitutional government or temporary suspension is yet another matter. And it may, as you suggest, it may be temporary suspension, and then you go to the elections with a view then to consolidating more of a democratic dictatorship, a constitutional democracy under the disguise of military rule. I mean, and that's something that the U.S. is very familiar with, and they've been applying it all over the world. So why wouldn't they do it at home? The militarization of civilian institutions is already commenced. Patriot Act is that. The repeal of the Posse Comitatus Act, which is being lobbied by the Pentagon, which would essentially allow the Pentagon to take over civilian functions of police and judiciary. In other words, there would be no more LAPD, okay, and there would be no NYPD. Hollywood would have to adjust its assumptions as well. We wouldn't have civilian cops. We'd have the guys with green berets, okay? But that is happening already. Now, the second possibility is that there may be terror alerts and so on, and eventually we'll go to the elections. Whether the powers behind this government are pushing George W., I think remains to be seen, because I think Kerry probably be a good bet as well. I listened to him on CNN this morning, or yesterday, and he said, you know, we're going to do the war on terrorism even better than the Bush administration, right? He said, I mean, he's not, and this is a guy who knows. I mean, he investigated Iran-Contra in the Kerry report. I mean, I could quote him. You know, he looked at drug laundering and so on and so forth. It's not that he doesn't know. He knows that the war on terrorism is phony. He knows it more than we do. But he's going to toe the line, because ultimately civilian government is a puppet here. It's the intelligence and military people with their backers in the Council on Foreign Relations and the think tanks. And, of course, Lockheed Martin calls the shots on U.S. foreign policy. Let's not forget that. So that, I think, that's the kind of scenarios I see. And then there's the issue of election of e-democracy, where the Republicans may try to gain the victory by manipulating the vote counting. So let me stop there, because again, it's taking up too much time.
Right. Yeah.
And that's why we have two panelists left, each wanting to ask you a question, and we're not going to have time for audience participation this morning. I'm sorry. Carol. Paul?
Paul wants to go first.
Okay. Michelle, because of the ubiquity of American media, CNN, Fox, etc., they've not only succeeded in convincing the majority of the populations in the West that Al-Qaeda is a genuine threat to U.S. interests, that it's a Muslim boogeyman, etc., but they've also succeeded in convincing most of the Muslim world as well, because their media also infiltrates their domestic conversations on the subject of terrorism and America's role in the world. Now, given the fact that the U.S. has so incensed the Muslim world in recent years, if not longer, with this war on terrorism, you've got an incredible number of young Muslim men who are dying to sign up to Al-Qaeda based on this myth in order to fight the United States, thinking that this is going to be their role or way of doing this. I'm wondering to what extent Al-Qaeda might evolve or grow into its own independent monster and no longer be under the control of the United States and really become a true threat to the United States. That's the first part of what I want you to address. And the second question is, I want you to entertain for us what must be going through the mind of Osama bin Laden. Does he know his role for U.S. intelligence? Does he know that these various, boogeyman Al-Qaeda attacks against the United States are really only fostering more reaction by the U.S. and bombing more countries and cracking down on internal dissent? Or does he think that he is somehow doing Islam a favor? I mean, what's going through his head? Does he know his role?
Okay, I'll have to respond rather briefly to the questions with you in view of time limitations. First of all, I think that we must distinguish between Al-Qaeda and a number of Islamic resistance movements. Okay, they're not the same thing. Al-Qaeda is a very elusive network, invisible. We can't say the same thing of Hamas, let's say, or Islamic Jihad, particularly in Palestine. But certainly, this whole Islamic Brigade construct has the purpose of destroying resistance from secular organizations within the Middle East. You can see it in. In Palestine, you can see it. Well, you can see it in Iraq as well. Up to a point, you can see it. In Chechnya. So that, in effect, there's also an infiltration into these organizations. Hamas was supported by Israeli intelligence. We know that. Okay, but I don't think we should confuse the two things. There's a genuine resistance which may go through Islamic or church organizations in the Middle East, which is not necessarily tied to the Wahhabi sects in Saudi Arabia, but which constitutes a bona fide resistance to occupation in the West Bank or in Gaza Strip or in Iraq. Okay, I don't see that. That Al-Qaeda can't start working against the U.S. because Al-Qaeda is the U.S. Okay, Al-Qaeda is an organization controlled by U.S. intelligence. Whether the actors in the field know about this is another matter. That's the whole nature of an intelligence asset. Okay, I mean, there are lots of intelligence assets. There may be intelligence assets in this room. Okay, I would expect that there would be. Okay. And they don't necessarily know that they're being manipulated and into doing certain things. Now, Osama bin Laden, I don't even know. He's a mythical figure. He's a member of the bin Laden family. The bin Laden family is linked to the Bush family. They go way back. I don't think that this is necessarily the answer, because you'll notice that the U.S. fabricates figureheads. The most recent one is al-Zarqawi. His name is cropping up every day in the news. He's in several places at the time. He's in Madrid, he's in Iraq, he's all over the place. It's fabricated.
Carol?
Yeah. Oh, I just wanted to add to that. We had a press conference in San Francisco the other week, and I got a phone call from Stanley Hilton, who has a suit against the Bush administration on behalf of taxpayers for criminality, fraud, 9/11, et cetera. And at the very last minute, just as we were starting the press conference, he rushed up to me. But he was going to use as the premise of his suit the fact that Osama bin Laden had been dead for 5 years. And I was pretty stunned to hear that because what? I'd never heard that one before. So who is Osama bin Laden? Is he alive? I mean, I think the U.S. is definitely using him. But I want to ask the question. I think I owe my sanity the fact that I stopped watching television when I was 17 years old. And I think it's the most powerful psychological warfare tool against us. And we're the most propagandized society in the world, the Americans, definitely the target of the heaviest propaganda. And what astounds me is how other governments or other people could support the big lie or the myth that other governments aren't challenging them. And I think India was under tremendous pressure when they did come up with the evidence linking the head of Pakistani intelligence to the Bush administration. I think their parliament was terrorized and they were on the brink of nuclear war with Pakistan, and then they just sort of shut up about it. And I wonder what's happening now with Europe. The co-option of the left in the United States is trying, it seems to be giving the American people a false choice between a national fascism headed by Bush or a transnational fascism headed by the UN, where the imperial powers could divvy up the rest of the world. So what is going on in Europe? Are they just trying to figure out, you know, how to divvy up the world and use the UN as a means of doing so? Or are they going to actually actively challenge the big lie?
Okay. These are still very complex questions. I'd just like to first address the first part of your question on India and Pakistan, because they're very important. When the Union Parliament was bombed back in 2001, the groups which claimed responsibility for these attacks were proxies of Pakistan's inter-services intelligence, okay? In other words, and that's not me was saying it, it's the Council on Foreign Relations. Go to their homepage, okay? So there are three organizations in Kashmir, separatist groups. They claimed responsibility for these bombings. And if you go to the webpage of the Council on Foreign Relations, they will say Pakistan Inter-Services Intelligence, in other words, General Mahmoud, controls these groups or supports these groups. Now, then you could, if you connect the dots, you say, well, how come Colin Powell supports the general and the general supports these groups? It's clear that that bomb attack is connected to the intelligence network, Pakistan and the United States. So, secondly, Bali, Jamia Islami, when there was the Bali bombing, Jamia Islami is said to be supported by Indonesian intelligence. Now, everybody knows Indonesian intelligence is supported by U.S. intelligence, going back to the reign of Suharto and the military government. So again, we have to beg these questions without necessarily coming up with wild speculations. But they show that there is a cover up. Now, with regard to Europe is now embarked on a process under the European Constitution, which is militarization. They want to do a copy and paste of the program of the new American century. They are building their military, they are putting money into the military, they're asking the new members of the European Union to join in this, and the central agenda is the military alliance between France and Germany, the Franco-German alliance, and it is very much emulating the same doctrine as the Bush administration, because ultimately Europe is also part of the of Bush's war of conquest. Eventually what they want to do is to destabilize Europe and undermine this countervailing power. There's a lot of awareness in Europe. I had a three-hour session in the European Parliament where we discussed the same issues as today. I had support of everybody. There was only one guy from the Green Party who actually is the ruling party. The Social Democrats supported it. They all wanted to debate it. There were actually as many people in the room as there are today. There is a debate, but you're right. The media in Europe, the media in the Middle East are pushing the war on terrorism dogma. And that's because the media groups in Europe and the media groups in the States, you know, they work together, buddy-buddy. And the problem is that the Europeans don't have an alternative project for their respective societies. They don't. In other words, it's global capitalism. There is no European project which is distinct. It's militarization. So that is my answer very briefly on that question, and it certainly points to some very important issues on the relationship between the Anglo-American, Australian, Canadian axis on the one hand, which is a military axis, and the Franco-German axis, which is the core of the European military-industrial complex.
And that was Professor of Economics and International Development Michel Chesedowski from the University of Ottawa. Professor Chesedowski is also the director of the Center for Research on Globalization. His most recent book is War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th. Thanks to Hamoux and the video team of the International Citizens Inquiry on the Unanswered Questions of 9/11 for that recording. September 9th and 11th, 9/11truth.org will sponsor two large successive inquiries in New York City, a preliminary 9/11 Citizens Commission hearing, and Confronting the Evidence, 9/11 and the Search for Truth, a research-focused evidentiary forum. These inquiries will examine many of the 9/11 commission-shunned questions and discuss preparation of a probable cause complaint demanding a grand jury and criminal investigation from the New York Attorney General. For details, see 911truth.org, that's 911truth.org, or contact Kyle Hentz at area code 212-243-7787. And on a related issue that would provide a significant motive for complicity in a terrorist attack that would create a willingness in the nation for war in the Middle East, the Finger Lakes Back to Democracy group will present an evening of information and discussion on peak oil and oil depletion with Michael Doliner. That's on Monday, September 13th at 7 p.m. in Perry City at the Perry City Friends Meeting House. The meeting house is located on Route 227 in Perry City, just north of the intersection of Route 228. That's Monday, September 13th, 7 p.m. at the Perry City Friends Meeting House. The event is free and open to all. For more info, contact Margo at area code 607-387-5080, 387-5080. Our theme music and welcome guest is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening. Just like